Now, I see David is now a speaker with us here on stage. Hello, David. I would say I'll leave the floor right now to David, so he can say his hellos to us, give us a small introduction. Been a while since I heard his voice, and I miss it a lot.
Hey, Eddie. Nice to hear you. Well, Eddie, don't be fooled with that. Eddie and I worked together on a number of things, and we had some nice in-person meetings, and now we mostly communicate remotely. But yeah, I was just asked to give some basic background here, and you know, because the judging isn't coming up for a while. So I'm happy to try to evaluate these the contestants, and I'm totally agree with Mel that it'd be really great to see some good stuff built on top of all this. Maybe many of you know, just a real quick background, that in the late 1970s, I realized how important digital technology would be for ordinary people in the future. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah, all
Okay.
good.
Mel
Everyone's just
just
listening.
sent me a message. Yeah. And anyway, so I started trying to figure out what would happen moving forward, and I realized how critical privacy was to the choice between whether it would be a Web 2 world or a Web 3 world in today's terminology. In other words, would companies and government in a centralized way kind of control people through digital technology, or would people be empowered with their own computers and, well, later I realized, keys to protect their own interests? And so there's a big difference there. That's something I felt very strongly about. I wanted to sort of save humanity and try to steer things in the Web3 direction. So I, excuse me, spent a bit of time trying to figure out how people could protect their informational lives in a digital world. And this is when I realized that cryptography was the key, no pun intended, was the way to do it, only way to do it, in fact, the only way to create real structure in a digital world and to allow people to enforce protection of their own information, their own rights, their own privacy, money, and so forth. And so that's when, in the end of the 70s and the first year or so of the 1980s, if you can, this is way before the web or anything, I figured out how you could do mixed networks, which is what XX Network does now. And this is, excuse me, as I'm sure many of you realize, the way to protect the privacy of basically who communicates with whom and when. So messages are routed in a, the internet is a packet switching network, and mixing could be built in, but currently it's only an overlay. And you can thank the National Security Agency and their various contractors like BBN for that. Go back and look at the original RFPs, I'm sorry, RFCs, in the early days of the Internet Society. You can see all this stuff. And the chairman of the privacy working group was an employee of BBN, which is a military contractor in Boston. And he wrote in the introduction that, under no circumstance could cryptography be used to protect the privacy of header information. That's what Steve Kent wrote while he was being paid by the National Security Agency. and put it in this public standard. I mean, can you imagine that? Have you ever seen something like that in an RFC, you know, where it would say, you know, what you can't do? It's supposed to tell you how to make interoperable standards, not say no one can ever, you know, do this, right? But it's what it says. Go look at it. Thanks to the NSA, people try to bring this up subsequently, and it was always shot down, you know, very energetically. Really, mixing should be in at the, you know, protocol level of the IP stack, right? The routers should be allow mixing. They should allow the encryption of header information, but they don't. So mixing today is only as a so-called overlay on the network, which of course makes it much more expensive and slower, you know, and it's, you have to try to get people to use it. And so it's not very widely used, but it is increasingly used, and that's great news. I'm not here to promote XX Network, but you can have a look. You know, the foundation's making a lot of progress there, getting a lot of different kinds of use cases to run over the network. So that was one of the things I came up with was mixing. And the other thing was blind signatures for untraceable payments, like so-called eCash. And what I think most people aren't really aware of or recognize that actually it's just a generalization of eCash. Strictly speaking, what I've called, like in the Scientific American article, which you can find a copy of on my website, chom.com, you know, where I lay out how you can combine mixing for communication privacy with eCash for payments privacy, and then what I called credential mechanisms, the generalization of eCash for all kinds of personal information, where you would basically keep the database of information about yourself in the form of signatures by government and organizations that were issued to you, and then you could prove various assertions about those in so-called zero knowledge or minimum disclosure, something which I had a lot to do with creating, but that's a story for another day. I mean, you know, I think it was Henry Kissinger, now deceased, who said that, you know, academic fights are the most bitter, you know, because there's so little to fight about, he said, you know. So, okay, I invented a more general notion than zero knowledge. The one that includes SNARKs was so-called minimum disclosure. I showed how they are duals of each other. The more general result, how you could, they all reduce directly to circuits. But certain people in the field who are still with us tried to cover that up and pretend like it was all about zero knowledge and that was the whole thing. So that's really a travesty. But in any event, but just when I was starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know, how these protocols could provide privacy, there was a glimmer of it. I was, you know, quite enthusiastic about pursuing this. The National Security Agency got a new director, a new head of it, and this guy said that it was his opinion that anything to do with cryptography was born classified, and that if you you know, you had to keep it secret, and so if you organized a conference about cryptography, then he was going to put you in jail and, like, throw the book at you, the weight of the federal government at you. And he said as much in letters, which he wrote to the IEEE and the ACM and so on. And this was reported in Science Magazine. You can read about it on my itchom.com under the IACR panel, because what I did was, of course, you know, a good Berkeley graduate student in cryptography who saw how important it was going to be for for Protecting People from Government in the future would do, start a conference on cryptography. And fortunately, I didn't end up spending the rest of my life in jail, but I did found the International Association for Cryptologic Research and announced it at that first conference. And, you know, so that has the backing of the UN and all this. And you can read up all about it. The reporter who broke this story in Science magazine, by the way, has a funny name, which is easy to remember. Her name is Gina Colada. Okay, I haven't seen her, doing much recently. But she wrote about this. And no one could believe it at the time, that the government was trying to make cryptography be born classified like nuclear, weapons. But there you have it. So that's pretty much. And then I had a lot to do with the cypherpunks and inspiring them. And I spent a lot of time working on this kind of thing and going around giving lectures about it at universities. And the articles were published in major journals. What was the best journal of computer science at the time? ACM invited, appeared there on the cover of that. Later invited to Scientific American and appeared there in a more, abridged edited form in, I think, 12 languages. And, people love this whole idea that you could control your own information and through cryptography by basically keeping everything private using mixing, untraceable electronic money, and credential mechanisms. So it's kind of a comprehensive solution. And so, but a lot of the people you hear about in connection with Bitcoin were my, friends and colleagues, and I hosted a lot of visitors in Amsterdam at our offices, DigiCash, where we issued eCash, our own cyberbucks like Bitcoin, right? And then we also had licensees like Deutsche Bank and which was the largest bank in Europe at the time, and other, was available and issued in U.S. dollars and a number of other currencies by various banks around the world. So that was pre-Bitcoin, and, it wasn't fully decentralized. But, I don't feel guilty about that because of two things. One, there wasn't enough computing power really to decentralize it fully at that time. And we had trouble getting it to run on the 386s and 486s that people were using. And the other thing was that we actually spent a lot of time, and this is not, I maybe haven't said this publicly before, but I think I'll end on this. We spent a lot of time, and that's two of the really key people at DigiCash, super great, brilliant young Dutch guys, Jelte and Niels and I, we would spend, hours, many evenings in we had a conference room, with whiteboards on like two sides, a lot of whiteboard space. Big windows and stuff, and we would spend hours in there working on trying to figure out all different ways to decentralize this stuff. So it wasn't like, we didn't want to, or we, some people said, you could have minted more eCash, you stolen eCash. Well, no, at that time, no one ever said that. So eCash, the was Cyberbucks, we issued it. And we said we're going to issue only $1 million worth, Cyberbucks worth. That's it. And anyone who opened a shop that would accept Cyberbucks, we airdropped them, what you say now, we gave them some free Cyberbucks. And if you go to Chom.com and look at the eCash panel, you can see the eCash Museum and a lot of the shops and see what they were selling and stuff through. This is a lot of it's reconstructed through the Wayback Machine, so it's not all there, but quite a bit of it is there. If you hover over the, the icons of the shops and click through on their names, you'll see some of their web pages and what they were selling and So that was the Cyberbucks system. So we actually had, you know, quite a lot of people realize how important all this was going to be. Okay, I think I've burned up my airtime, and thanks for listening. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
David, thanks so much for joining us here and also, you know, supporting us here in our journey. It was, a year back, I think. I mean, we met at one of the Satoshi roundtables and then reconnected in Dubai. And was a great moment for Eddie to be introduced to you. And even greater after a few calls that we were able to convince you kind of to support us, and we are very, very thankful that you are helping us to, you know, to build what we are building now with PowerChain. And
Mel. You know, when we met, you and I met a couple years ago, I was very impressed by, you know, the way you, the projects that you had been working on and what you described and so on. And that's really, yeah, what motivated me to say, yeah, I would like to continue to, you know, to back you. And it's been fun working with Eddie on some of the real tricky inner details. That's the kind of stuff I do just for fun, it's been good. Thank you very much. It's really great.
No, thank you for being here. Go ahead, Eddie.
Yeah, I just want to say it's been a pleasure working with you, David. First, I was very happy that I was able to have head-to-head conversations with someone like you. It's kind of gave me a big satisfaction that I'm on that level where I can have head-to-head conversations with no problem. I can understand everything you're saying and go along with it and improve on it together and all of that. So it was very satisfying and assuring for me on the level I've reached so far. It's also been amazing working furthermore on MHBS together. And also another thing, guys, because I don't know if anyone mentioned it, but to those of you who don't know, David Schaum, as he just said right now, he's the creator of eCash, or digital cash, it was called, which actually Bitcoin took as reference when being built. And David Schaum is one of the most mentioned people in the Bitcoin white paper.
Well, let's put it this way, Eddie, that, you know, when I made the first eCash payment at the first World Wide Web conference, which was held in Geneva at CERN, where the web was invented, there were two keynotes, Tim Berners-Lee and me, right? And mine was first, that I made a payment, the first international eCash payment back to Amsterdam. And I wrote a like three-paragraph press release, sent it back to our amateur PR, part-time PR guy in the company, Paul Dennison. And within like 48 hours, there were articles in, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, everywhere, all around the planet, you know, because the smaller publications always followed the bigger ones in those days. And it was the idea that a number could be worth money, a digital bearer instrument. That's kind of what I got credit for inventing, and that kind of, you know, rocked the world. And, you know, you could say, well, I'll leave it to you, to the listener here, to decide whether Bitcoin is on a similar standing or, you know, what the relative. That was a very big deal, because prior to that, you know, the only, you know, bearer instruments were stock certificates and banknotes. And to make it, be a digital bearer instrument, solve a double spending problem, and actually build it and make it work and everything. It's kind of a big deal, I think. So anyways, it was really, you know, fun and rewarding. We had a great company, you know, we went on like these, you know, team building things. You know, we rented like one of these old Dutch sailing ships and sailed it across the eye, you know, and it was just a great working with all these peoples. And, Zabo, we had him there for a while. And Zuku, who had, you know, went by a different name at the time, but, you know, he he worked there for a couple years, and I just wanted him just to work on his own thing. And so even though we paid him, he just, you know, I just helped him try to figure out a better way to do eCash than we were doing it. That was his project. So that bore some fruit. Anyways, okay, enough for me.
No, I can imagine that. That's definitely what you just mentioned. Like, I'm imagining if I were in your shoes, that's definitely a historical moment and historical times to remember. And in a way, they pushed the way to where we are today. So thank you for all of that.
Maybe, I don't know if, David, I'm not sure about your schedule. I know you're a little bit tight today, but if there are some questions, I see.
I have some visitors here at my home, and I think I need to talk to them because they're on their way.
Adam, I see he has his hands up.
I'll just sneak this one in, David. Huge fan. We met at the roundtable as well one time, and I don't think there's anyone more important to in the history of Bitcoin than you. Actually, I was just having a talk today with somebody who's writing a book, and one of the sections is about Satoshi, and contemplating who it is. Not saying it's you, but when we're talking about who's important in the history of blockchain and Bitcoin, you're obviously at the pinnacle. Quick question though, on current state of privacy and blockchains. Obviously, U.S. government's going after people who are creating privacy tools. I just wanted to know your current feelings on the matter and where you think we sit as an industry trying to protect people's privacy.
Well, you know, Adam, thanks for the kind words. And that's a question that calls for a pretty elaborate set of issues and discussion points and so forth. But, I would say it's, let me try to avoid this. So, I hope people don't get discouraged because, you know, there is bad news out there. You know, the so-called travel rule, you know, is gearing up. You know, it's coming into enforcement in different jurisdictions. Even though, you know, it was introduced, you know, more than a year ago, but it's starting to actually take force in some places. If you look at what the powers that be are really up to, which is something I know a lot about because I'm, you know, I do hang with some of these people as well. Don't hold it against me. I mean, I have the luxury and freedom to, you know, enter a lot of different circles. And, I spent a bunch of time at the Satoshi Roundtable, speaking of which, you know, at the Bitcoin maximalist sessions, you know, really trying to, you know, get into it and everything and really hear this all out. There's bad stuff. There's movement in a, you know, anti-privacy direction. Certainly happening. And, you know, the crazy things have happened, as you all know. I mean, can you imagine putting a developer in jail who's in another country or something? It's ridiculous stuff. But there are some sort of behind the scenes countervailing things happening. You know, in the United States, so we have this kind of like idiomatic expression or vernacular, something. It comes from the advertising world, you know, with billboards. Sometimes the billboards will just say something like, "Watch this space," you know, to mean that company's probably going to announce something soon, but they can't say what it is right now. So I'd like to say, watch this space. You know, I'd like to say you haven't seen anything yet. Maybe that's a little too strong, but I've got some new stuff that I think can change the debate. You know, it's not just an either or thing. It's it's a bit complex, and I think there's stuff that can be done, and there's certainly improvements possible at the layer one. You know, this is something a lot of people don't realize, and I was just at a really nice event in Tokyo with it was really nice to be there. The people are so kind to have me there and everything, but you know, I couldn't really bring myself to say it. You know, I was on stage with Vitalik and everything, but you know, we had this panel, and I just couldn't say it. You know, I mean, the Plasma people are all happy about trying to make better privacy as a kind of layer, you know, two, you know, an add-on kind of a thing. And honestly, you know, if I were to really speak my mind, I'd have to say, you know, you cannot build privacy on, you have to build it in. It's the same as with security. You cannot build security onto something that already exists. It has to be architected in from the beginning. Otherwise, it's hopeless. These are hard problems. And yeah, privacy's, you know, it's, I don't know, comparable hard as security. It's a tricky stuff. So, yeah, I'm sorry for the maybe long-winded answer, but I think there's hope, and you know, ideas can be very powerful, and it's not just a, you know, them or us, a cut and dried black and white issue of privacy or no privacy. It's quite a subject. You know, I mean, you know, Vitalik commented that there are really no metrics for privacy at that panel. That's not exactly, strictly speaking, true. And I tried to politely point out, you know, that we have developed metrics like anonymity sets, and you know, there's information theoretic analysis and various other stuff. But you know, it's also true that in these real world applications, it's hard to really get your head around the privacy issues and you know, all the models and what's really offered, what, you know, what the worst case, you know, what an attacker could really glean, and all the various scenarios and so forth. It can become very complex. So anyways, don't lose heart. I think there's a lot of room to do some great stuff. And thanks, Adam, for this question. You know, I guess you struck a nerve here. One more thing I want to add, and then I really have to go with that. That is, you know, I think we are in a very different world today with respect to privacy. Just in the last couple of years, because of AI. And so there's two aspects, right? There's the historical damage to civilization that's been done by artificial intelligence, you know, in some of its more primitive forms, in, you know, Web 2 social media. You know, it's created a fractionation, social court. It's really done a number on civilization, and that's a horrible thing. And now, let me just, without, you know, I said more, and you could look at some of my presentation, perhaps, at the Plasma conference. I think it was live streamed, but it's on Twitter. So, you know, nowadays, privacy with AI is really represents a much higher stakes game. Because think of it this way, if, let's just say, really bad forces, whether they're human or not, get a hold of some portion of civilization, you know, they can use AI to hold on to their power. And that means that they can use robots and, you know, all this stuff and spy on people and brainwash people through AI. And it's really not easy to imagine that, you know, we would be able to shake off such a bad form of governance. You know, it used to be you just, you know, pry some pavers, some stones out of the street and start throwing them, and, you know, governments would listen. But when they know everything about you, you don't have privacy, and then, you know, and they're ferreting out all this information and putting all these pieces together with AI, and then, you know, with the vastly more powerful, you know, I mean, humans can't really, I think, have a fair fight with a AI-powered robot with automatic, you know, weapons and everything. I mean, have you seen any of this stuff? It's, like, super frightening, right? So it's like the balance of power has tipped. So if we lose control now, you know, it's not ever coming back. Get over it. It's not the same old world. Like, you know, we could try these experiments and we could always claw our way back. No, this is it. It's sort of, you know, you only get one chance going forward, and that's because of AI. And the more AI knows about all of us, the you know, the easier it is for someone to really usurp power. And that's where the privacy thing comes in. But there's more to it. So a lot of the debate has changed because of AI. And, you know, AI can help people and, you know, protect their own privacy, right? Because a lot of these tools that we develop are very complex, difficult to use. What you need is, you know, put it this way, and I really will shut up then. I really have to end this call. But my speaking here, but I'll try to listen. The thing is, in future, if I have a personal AI, it will tell me the products and services to use that are best for me. And if the user experience is the same as the non-privacy ones, it will just go directly to those. So it's not, so the privacy-based apps and information services and so on are not going to be at any disadvantage. In fact, they will be favored. And they can expect to receive, you know, massive immediate adoption. It's a very different world. You know, you can do all the hype and marketing you want, but you're not going to fool people's personal AIs. They'll figure out what to do, and they'll do the right thing, and they will choose the products that have privacy if the user experience is similar, but that's what AI can also help with. So, and the importance of the privacy is, you know, amped up because of these downside scenarios that I mentioned. So, anyways, I look forward to meeting all of you personally and staying in touch through this and everything. And I think our community is, you know, on the right side of all this, and it's a critical, it's becoming all the more critical. So, it's so great to be here with all of you. So thanks again.
Thanks so much, David. Thanks so much for joining us this evening or this morning, your noon. Wherever you are, was very insightful, and we're really very honored that you're working with us. And for all the startups that are building on Bitcoin Plus, they get in front of David for seeing the projects, judging it. So please join us and join the Bitcoin Olympics Hackathon. Thanks so much, David, for your time. It was amazing to have you with us.